Did you know your calendar age doesn't always match how old your body truly is? At least according to the True Age test from True Diagnostic. Biological age shows how fast you're aging internally, and it's a key predictor of serious disease risk. Research says if your biological age is just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk for diseases like cancer or heart disease can spike by 30 to 50%. The good news? You have influence over your true age through lifestyle, habits, and environment. I was surprised to learn my blood has fewer toxins than most, but I'm deficient in vitamin C and B2, and I need to eat more valine-rich foods like nuts, dairy, and meat. The True Age test was a breeze. Just a quick finger prick at home, no doctor visit needed. You mail it off, and in 2 to 3 weeks, you get a detailed report on your aging. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head out to truediagnostic.com and use my code, Harris, to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use HARRIS at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. We are live now on the Conversations That Matter podcast. Let us try this again. I feel like it's becoming a tradition now to make sure the audio works. So let me know if the audio works. I just tried a few minutes ago and seems like people couldn't hear me. So hopefully that problem's rectified now. I'm going to pretend that it's working and just keep going here. The reason we're doing a late night live stream is because I won't have the opportunity to do a live stream later this week. And I will have a video dropping on Thursday, but I'm actually going to be taking a few days with my wife and my baby to go on a little mini vacation in New Hampshire. So that'll probably be, actually, I'm not even sure if it's 3 or 4 days because my wife planned it. So I'll find out after the podcast. I think it's 4 days, but we'll be back at the end of the week. And Luke says it's loud and clear. Good. All right. So anyway, that's why we're doing this late at night, but no worries if you're listening later. This is an evergreen podcast. We're going to be talking about the leftist, or if you prefer progressive, I guess, takeover of churches. I use that word on purpose because I don't think this is just political. I think it's cultural, it's political. It is driven by, I think, an effort. You could even say modernist. It's an effort to modernize the church. And this really became clear to me probably in the last 3 or 4 months that what is currently taking place, what we've observed for years now, what I've been tracking since 2019, at least on the local church level, you could say before that to some extent, because I've been tracking the woke stuff before that, but on the local church level, seeing churches that are orthodox in their theology, traditional in their aesthetics and their culture of the church and everything, seeing them get taken over, seeing not just the stuff of 2020, which, you know, BLM and the COVID stuff, but also just seeing them get rid of traditional legacy ministries and new make the church sterile and take the church's character and identity away. These kinds of things are more than just political moves. They are revolutionary moves. It's not just about votes. It's not just about, it could be for some, maybe they want churches to be more welcoming to Democrats and that kind of thing. But it's not, I think, just that. I think this is so much bigger. This is about fundamentally reshaping what a church looks like, what a church is, how it functions, what people think of when they think of church. That's what's going on. And it's to suit, I think, in the minds of the people who are orchestrating this, demographics that they think they need to attract. And they think that they'll be attracted if the church isn't a church. It doesn't look like a church. Because things like choirs and steeples and hymns and formal dress and Sunday school and kids programs and all the things you associate with a church, that stuff is not what people are really after. In fact, maybe that offends people. Seeing an American flag when they walk in and a Christian flag, those things could offend people. What they really need is our formulaic version of church that we've concocted in the lab that we call the seminary or the consulting firm. And we're going to just force this on churches. That's what's going on. So it's to suit an audience they think that they need or that they can attract that isn't being attracted by the traditional church setting. So I'm going to go into all this. It might sound kind of like seeker sensitive stuff, but I think you could say that there's a market driven element, but I think it's beyond that. I don't think it's like your 90s or early 2000s. We're going to have a rock band and attract all the kids. I think this is even deeper than that, to be quite honest with you. It's not just a formula for getting people. It's also a formula for reconciling the church to the zeitgeist of the age. So it's more than just numbers. In fact, some of the examples I give you, in fact, all three examples I give you, numbers actually went down when these attempts were made to fundamentally change these churches that I'll show you in a minute. And it was still viewed as the right thing to do to fundamentally alter the identity of the traditional American church. So, we'll get into it. We got some comments already coming in, and we're being propagandized around the clock about World War III, but John stays focused on the homeland. Got to respect it. Yeah, what am I going to do? There's only so much you can talk about with World War III. And I don't really have the influence to do much about it either way. But we can keep our churches strong, and that will help in World War III if it comes to that. Preach the gospel, love and help people. Sounds good, Craig. I love that. And Drew Smith followed up, spreading the SBC formula to entire Free Will Baptist denomination. Most Free Will Baptists are old school type churches. You know, I have been flooded with examples of situations people are saying I should investigate that are from all kinds of different, mostly SBC, but also other denominations or non-denominational churches. And I would not be surprised if Free Will Baptists are experiencing the same kind of thing. I think that this is just a thought I've been having lately, but I think a lot of the evangelical denominations are going through what I'm describing here. They have been going through this for some time, but in the SBC, it seems like there's a special kind of formula for specifically going into a church and remaking it in a short period of time. And I don't know if that is being employed all across, you know, these other traditions and so forth. It could well be, but the SBC seems to have a special knack for this. And I'll probably do a follow-up episode where I will show you some of the roots of this, which might surprise you, to be quite honest. I already have some names that I need to investigate more, but I have some names that I'm pretty suspicious of that were on the ground floor of the strategy that I'm going to be describing. So why don't we get to it? Why don't we talk about that strategy? Right before we get to it, though, I do want to let you know about a few things. Two announcements. One is, I got these books in the mail for my daughter. She's going to be turning one on the 21st. This I Know, Seeing God in the World He Made, and then this book called Just the Gospel. These are really great kids' books. I've already read them to my daughter, and she is already, you can see, she's already put her mark on it. She thinks books taste good. I'm trying to convince her. They don't, she's supposed to read them. You don't just eat them, but she wants to eat the Word of God, so we'll just try to encourage that in a more prudent direction as she gets older. But these books came free of charge to me from Mud Hen Mama. And so I want to just give them a shout out. If you are looking for good books, there's books for adults as well. But if you're especially looking for books for your children, Mud Hen Mama has a curated list of great books, and they're age appropriate. They give you a breakdown. Go to mudhenmama.com. If you want to find out more, I would rather support them than Amazon or Barnes & Noble or some of these other places that also push a bunch of woke nonsense. Go to Mudhead Mama and you don't have to worry about any of that. You're supporting a family-run business, and the curation is top-notch. So you don't have to worry about receiving books that are going to be compromised in any way. So anyway, wanted to give that shout out now that I'm in that phase of life where we're actively keeping our eye out for good books and good toys and wholesome material for a daughter who's getting older and more curious every day. Okay, so let's, one last thing I said. Music and Masculinity Conference is coming up in September. You're going to want to sign up for this, even if you're not a musician. I think some people think you have to be a musician or something to appreciate it. We're going to have topics that are go outside of just music. But even on the music front, this is going to be incredibly interesting. And I think unlike any other conference you've been to that even talks about music from a Christian perspective, I've put together speakers that I think are going to be really good on these topics. Of course, I'm going to be speaking there on Thursday. We have A.D. Robles also speaking on Friday morning. And our topics are not directly related to music. I'm going to be talking about a defense of tradition. And that might sound like, oh, no, what are you doing? Defending tradition. We should be defending the word of God. Well, you have to come. I'll explain. It is about defending the word of God. But I think that there's an appropriate place for passing down wisdom from the past. And we've lost that. And so I'll be trying to get practical ways to shore that up and explain why it's important. A.D. Robles is going to be talking about life work balance, that kind of thing. And then we got, Tim Bouchong, who's going to be there. He's a professional musician, and he's going to be talking about the commercial end of Christian music and the problems, I suppose, with it. I mean, we'll let him talk. I'm giving him a broad topic here. And then I'm really looking forward to this. Mark Steinmeier, who is, you've never heard of him, but he's actually, so he's Danny Steinmeier, Pastor Danny Steinmeier's father. And Danny's been on the podcast before. But, you know, Mark is one of these guys. He's actually written a lot, but it's not published. It's just on his computer and his hard drive. So I stayed with him when I was speaking at Truth Family Bible Church there in Idaho. Sorry, why did I say Iowa? Because they sound so similar to me. In Idaho. Anyway, I'm in the living room, and Mark Steinmeier has a piano there, and he starts playing, and he just starts showing me on the piano the difference between modern worship music and traditional worship music. And it was like, it just made connections in my mind that I've never had made before. And I thought, he's got to come and explain this. I want him to explain it to everyone. So I'm excited for that. And then my dad's actually going to be preaching on Sunday morning, which has never happened. He usually leaves, and I'm forcing him to stay on Sunday so that he has to relax. He's not going to be driving back at like 11 p.m. on a Sunday night to try to get back to church so he can preach the next morning. I'm just going to like make it so that the schedule doesn't allow that. So he has to be there on Sunday and preach at the camp center. And it's a wonderful camp center. So check it out, musicandmasculinity.com. We got great rates. And if you can't afford it, let me know, and we'll see about getting you a scholarship. All right. Well, now that we've gotten all that out of the way, let's talk about the topic at hand, which is, like I said, the takeover, or, I mean, I think I've had like three different titles here, depending on the article, the silent takeover, how evangelical churches are being remade from within. That was my American Reformer title, because I put a very long piece. You can look, you know, I'm still scrolling. Okay. This piece is really long. It's like 7,680 words or something like that. It's pretty thorough. And you can go to American Reformer and check it out. And then I put a shorter version of this out through the Federalist called Beware of the Progressive Playbook to Modernize Conservative Christian Churches. And it's much shorter, but same kind of content. And then, of course, I also put out a tweet thread that got some likes and so forth. And that is a quiet revolution is thread, how evangelical churches are being remade from within. So that is mostly picture driven. That's like this is the version I think my daughter can almost apprehend. So, and it's probably the one most people read, who knows, but there you go. So there's a number of versions of what I'm about to tell you already out there in print form, but I'm going to tell you in video form, and you can interact with me during the live broadcast, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. So I think I'm going to work off of this piece. I'm going to play you some clips also later after we're done of Greer and Platt trying to defend themselves. But let me explain what's going on. I'll read some of this to you. I talk about how I started out in 2019. I didn't know what I was getting into at the time, but there was a phone call that I received. I still remember where I was, from the Dolans, who were at First Baptist Church in Naples, Florida. I still remember where I was. I was walking on Liberty University's campus. It was the twilight hour in December, and they were describing what was happening at their church. And I was a little familiar with the case because I was already tracking the social justice stuff. I had the podcast probably for, I don't know, about 11 months already. I had been podcasting on this topic. And as everything was unfolding as far as social justice is concerned, you had Resolution 9 in the SBC the year before. You had the MLK 50. You had, what else did you have? You had the T4G conference. I think that might have been the year. You also had the Shepherd's Conference Q&A where Al Mohler got all upset. And so all of these things were just percolating. And you could sense tension. And some people were denying it, peace, there is no peace. But it was just getting more and more intense until December of that year, there was this church, First Baptist Naples Church of Florida, that all of a sudden online was accused of harboring they had in their membership role these racists that were this demonic spirit ripping the church apart. And leadership went after them in these terms and sent a letter to the Southern Baptist Convention notifying them that they had these people, that they had excommunicated them essentially. And it was unlike anything I'd ever seen before. What church sends a letter to the Southern Baptist Convention, to their denomination, saying, we've got this racist problem? And this was, of course, waved in my face immediately by guys who wanted to say, John, you've been saying that the woke stuff is a boy who cried wolf. And look, it's not crying wolf, because look at these people. Of course, who would lie about this? Of course, they're these horrible, neo-Nazi types or something, like down in Florida, Naples, Florida. And I remember the Baptist blogger was saying, well, that part of Florida's got its problems because you got Tom Askell down there in where is he? Fort Myers or somewhere. So he's not far away. He's in Southwest Florida. That's just what you have in Southwest Florida. And I didn't know what to say exactly, because it was a pile-on. You had everyone from J.D. Greer to Jack Graham to just like so many different people. Russell Moore, they were all piling on saying, this is an outrage that you have this. This is terrible that you have these racists in the SBC. They have no place in our denomination. Until I found out none of it was true. None of it was true. And we went down there. After talking to the Dolans, Mike and Terry, I said, someone's got to tell your story. No one's going to tell it. I had never made a movie. I didn't have any film experience. I had a webcam in my wife's laundry room. That's the extent at that point. And so I had already been supporting a film called Enemies Within the Church, because they were going after the social justice stuff and they were trying to fundraise. So I'd spoken at a few of their fundraisers for them. And I called the director and I said, hey, there's this church in Florida going through this. I think we need to go down there. And they thought maybe this would coincide with the movie. They could use some of this for the movie. So he agreed. He got a film crew together and we all went down there. And my job basically was to be the intake for the interviews. So I didn't conduct the interviews, but I was screening the people who were about to give the interviews, and the interviews were conducted with Kerry Gordon. And it was so eye-opening to me. I wrote a little piece on social media about it after the fact, because once I heard all the stories from these members of what happened, what actually happened, it absolutely broke my heart. There were people crying, and people who had been baptized there, raised their kids there. Their life was at this church, and it had been just ripped away from them. And when I got there, I quickly found out this was not just about social justice either. That, of course, stole the headlines of the story, but this was about losing legacy ministries, losing Awana, losing Operation Christmas Child. Those kind of, I think Awana, I think I wrote down Awana here. The article has the primary source links and that kind of thing. But they took the guy who is John David Eady, he took down and he was like the executive pastor. So he took this shovel that was there to, I didn't know about this till a few weeks ago, to break the foundation. It was displayed at the church. He took it down and replaced it with bolt cutters to signify that the church needed to break away from the chains that were holding it back. And the way that it happened was they got rid of their pastor. They had this guy who is had been there forever, Hayes Wicker. And there was this scandal that was generated, but no one knew, like, it wasn't made public. So no one knew what it was. Security escorts the pastor off campus. Everyone thinks it must be bad. I come to find out later that he had signed an NDA, and it actually wasn't as it was portrayed. It was from what I understand, it was things like, you know, using the church credit card to buy a cup of coffee accidentally. It was stuff like that. But whatever the case was, they got rid of him very quickly without an explanation. That's the issue for me. There was no explanation. And then it became, they got this consulting firm in. Actually, the consulting firm, I think, came in right before this. And they had already, under John David Eadie, gone through a committee-led formation from congregational polity to committee-led to having this consulting firm, Oxano, come in and make suggestions or recommendations. And then getting rid of the pastor and then trying to force in this new young guy named Marcus Hayes. I know it's confusing, Hayes Wicker and Marcus Hayes, but Marcus Hayes was the guy they were trying to get in there. And he was not qualified according to their church constitution. And in all three of these cases, there's constitutional violations. So he was not, he didn't have the minimum experience necessary. And he also wanted to do things like, he wanted to get rid of Bible study leaders and make them facilitators. So they're like a less hierarchical approach. The car care ministry was ended right before he came. So there was all these changes being made. The car care ministry was one of their big outreaches, just ended. What else did I write down? There was an orphanage in Tanzania that was actually run by two of the supposed racists in the church. One of them was a deacon. His ministry was just cut. You know, there was all these things that happened. Like, they didn't want to do weddings anymore. There was weird stuff that the church had been involved with that now that they're not going to be involved with anymore. And, Awana was one of them. So Awana, women's ministry stuff, they were just like taking the identity of the church and wanting to completely restructure it. And I will admit this, at the time we were so focused on the woke stuff that some of this other stuff did not figure as prominently in the documentary, because it was, we just figured this is a political takeover, and that other stuff we kind of put into the category of, well, that's weird. Why would they want to take out all these other ministries? That's just kind of strange. But I guess they just want to remake everything, and it must all be like some kind of a woke generated mindset that they have. Well, we found out later. I found out through experiences with other churches that actually, no, there was a method to that too. And it wasn't just a political woke thing. I think you could take all the social justice elements out of this and you would still have a fundamental transformation of the church to make it not be the church it was, to steal its identity and to make it into something else. So anyway, Marcus Hayes comes, and Marcus Hayes wants to make these changes. Enough of the church doesn't want that. They also find out on social media, Marcus Hayes is a supporter of the BLM narrative. He thinks same-sex attraction is not a sin. And it was just too much for some of these people. So they vote against him, and he doesn't actually meet the threshold required to become the next pastor. And so they do what the other churches I'm going to describe also try to do, essentially. They decide to do a revote. But Marcus Hayes had already gotten another gig in another state, and so he leaves. And from what I understand, things were rocky with him, you know, at the next church he goes to. But as far as First Baptist Naples is concerned, this becomes a problem. This becomes like a vengeful thing. It almost seems that these people are that are part of the group that ends up defeating the measure to make Marcus Hayes the next pastor. They end up becoming marginalized, obviously called racist. There's weird stuff in there. Like, you know, one of the guys had like a business, and he let the Spanish ministry come in and minister to the people who worked at his business, and that was cut off. And there was not order of protection, but like, you know, trespassing orders that came down. You can't set foot on our property. to some of these people. And it was just like, it was crazy. It was just way overkill. They wanted to make an example of these members. And I think what, in the long run, I think what happened really in this situation was, it was too, in all three of these churches that I'm about to describe, it was too much change too fast. This church, under the direction of John David Eadie and a guy named Neil Dorrell, tried to change things. Neil Dorrell was the head of the pastoral search committee. They tried to change things so fast, and then they rammed it down the congregation's throat that Marcus Hayes was going to be the pastor. And they played videos from guys like Kevin Ezell, the North American Mission Board. And there was a letter of recommendation. I think they read it at church, from J.D. Greer, the president of the denomination. And it was like a coronation. They're like, we're so excited that you've chosen to have Marcus Hayes. He's going to be great. And he hadn't even been voted on yet. And I think that really just graded some people wrong. And if they were more prudent, if they had been more gradual, if they hadn't have pushed it down everyone's throat and made it a coronation, maybe they would have gotten away with it. But it just, they went so fast, and they're probably going to be smarter next time, to be honest. They're probably getting smarter, and they're going to do it more gradually. So you got to be paying attention if you're in a church that has something like this happening. But enough people stood up, but they were cast out of the church, and they didn't take legal action. And that, I think, is because they couldn't find a lawyer to, they didn't know what angle to take. This was early on in discovering that this kind of, these tactics were being employed. So it just kind of settled. And I mean, I write about what happened after the fact, but the drama didn't really end. You had one of Danny Aiken's sons, I think it was Jonathan Aiken, if I'm not mistaken, who ended up, becoming the interim pastor there, flying down from North Carolina, I think it was. And then eventually a guy named Alan Brumback became the actual, the pastor. And so that's what eventually happened. But in the in-between there, you had a guy named Dr. Eric Smith, who was scuttled by Jonathan Aiken, apparently, under the influence of Jonathan Aiken. You can read his letter. He has a letter there that he talks about this. And it's like, there was some weird SBC stuff going on there, just some really odd SBC related stuff. And it's like, how did this church, a lot of these, the members didn't even think about the SBC, never heard about the SBC. They're just part of this denomination. But all of a sudden, the SBC's got their hands all over this church, and they're very interested in it. And why is that? What's going on? I have my thoughts on why that church in particular. I can't prove it, but initially I thought, well, it's Florida at the time was a swing state. Maybe it's this is a red part of Florida. It is a political thing to try to influence politics. But now I think it's because the church is in an affluent area. It's a big giving church. It's also, so there's a monetary, I think, I would say, incentive. But there's also the fact that there's an attempt to remake the church into this 21st century thing. And to take a prominent, successful church that a guy like Hayes Wicker has spent time building up over years, has a good reputation in the community, is very successful. To take a church like that and then turn that into your success story, that is appealing. That's a shortcut. It's stolen valor. You don't have to actually do all the work. You can ride the coattails of someone else who's done the work and then make that the example of how successful you've been. And I think that might be the reason, but that's just my opinion. So I don't know 100%. So that was the first story. The second one was McLean Bible Church. And at McLean Bible Church, this is such an interesting thing to me. This documentary would never have happened had it not been for the Naples documentary. So there's some folks watching the documentary on YouTube. You can go watch it. You just type in First Baptist Naples. And they're from McLean Bible Church. And there's Judd Saul, for some reason, the director, decided to put at the end that the same thing was happening at McLean Bible Church. Well, some folks from McLean Bible Church saw that, and it caught their attention. And they decided that if the same thing was happening there, they were going to fight it. And that's exactly what they did. And out of that came a two-part documentary called The Real David Platt. You can, again, go on YouTube, go to the Church Reform Initiative. You can find all that. And I had the privilege of being involved. I did most of the interviews. And then the Church Reform Initiative, though, also the Burks did some interviews. They really brought the team together and made it happen, financed it, all the whole thing. They deserve a lot of credit here. So does Andrew Joyce, the editor. He basically put it together. I feel like compared to them, my involvement was basically just behind the scenes, consulting on phone calls over the years, and then showing up and just doing some interviews and so forth. But I think we're getting to the point now where the Church Reform Initiative understands the formula, they understand the play, and they have people that can do this stuff, whether I'm involved or not, which I am. I'm really thanking God for. That's a really, really good thing. But anyway, I came down and did some of these interviews. And again, very similar story. So like FBC Naples, McLean Bible Church had a good reputation in the community. They also had a legacy pastor there that who had grown the church to 16,000 people. It was a mega church. And his name was Lon Solomon. And this was known to be kind of a Republican hub. There was senators and congressmen and Fox News folks and even Donald Trump and Mike Pence had been there at times. And so it had this reputation. So you're talking like center right church at the very least. And then all of a sudden, you know, Lon Solomon, he says that in 2016 that he had no intentions of leaving, but then in 2017 he leaves and he says he was removed by the elders from all operational involvement. Well, you find out that behind the scenes, there's this guy named Dale Sutherland, who is working to essentially get David Platt. So David Platt is at this point the head of the IMB, the International Mission Board for the Southern Baptist Convention. And he is looking for a way out. And it seems like that's what was going on, at least. He ends up in coordination with Dale Sutherland coming to that church. And Dale and him are also coordinating with the Southern Baptist Convention to affiliate, meaning to give money. There's another guy there named Clint Clifton, who was a NAM missionary to Washington, D.C., and that this is the basis for the New City Network, which is this organization that McLean kind of hatches that does church planning in D.C., but it is also under the purview of the North American Mission Board somehow. So there's this merging of the Southern Baptist Convention with McLean Bible Church. Now, McLean Bible Church had a, in their constitution, a stipulation that they could not be affiliated with any denomination. So, of course, this is being broken to affiliate with the Southern Baptist Convention. And this continues for a few years, somewhat undetected. There's David Platt asked Dale Sutherland to find a way to increase SBC giving to 300,000. That was in when he first came on in 2017, in order to rank MBC among the denomination's top 20 giving churches. Now that should be a little bell going off. Why would he do that? This isn't public. This was found in Discovery, but why would he do that? And it turns out the North American Mission Board does have a hierarchy, if you will, of churches who give more, get more from the denomination. And it could be that that's what's going on here, but he seems very particular about he wants to be one of the top giving churches. He had already reformed, and Aiken's name comes up again, Paul Aiken, Jonathan Aiken's brother, his senior aide at the IMB and the son of Danny Aiken, SBC president, of his intentions to send money to the SBC of Virginia. So that's like the arm of the SBC in Virginia. By 2018, the New City Network updated its website to include the fact that MBC was in partnership with the Southern Baptist Convention. And through a lawsuit, it was found out that by 2021, the church had contributed over $2 million to the denomination, hiding much of it in line items like senior management, administration, and a box budget line, possibly at least a box budget line item that eluded detection. Even the church treasurer has come out now on camera and said, basically, there's dark money. I didn't know where any of this was going. I mean, this is scandalous stuff. And as violating as these changes were to the way the church was set up, they largely went unnoticed and perhaps would have remained that way, except for the fact that there were other serious violations that took place. So Platt wanted to change the way that they were thinking about church. And part of that was the woke stuff. He wanted this intergenerational multi-ethnic ministry. But he, so what he does is he introduces his class, the gospel, the church, justice, and race. And it teaches basically ideas consistent with critical race theory and advocates for things like collective repentance for historical racial oppression. Black criticizes Christians for not acknowledging race, failing to be sufficiently anti-racist, and not prioritizing diversity enough. And he does all these bonkers moves. He expresses regret for praying for President Trump in 2019. He justifies voting for pro-abortion Democrats. He does all this stuff that ends up just really cutting against the grain of the people who are there. But I'm telling you now, I think this is all by design. If you start getting rid of the legacy ministries and the people who run those ministries, you're getting rid of any potential opposition you have in the church. So there's no one to stand against you once you actually start implementing the changes you want. And that's what happened here. That's what was happening in Naples. It's what happened at Knightdale. But that's what was happening here. So I won't belabor the woke stuff. The woke stuff was bad. But anyway, what he also decided to do was get a business consultant. There's the consulting angle. It's like the same formula, named David Young, a business consultant, and he appoints him as executive pastor. And despite the church elders' disapproval of Young's influence, Platt reportedly had him remain on the payroll in a covert manner. And he and Platt have this strategy to get rid of these discipleship groups at NBC, calling them shallow and unhealthy. And they want to have more controlled groups that include up to 100 people. So you're getting rid of the community of the church, you're getting rid of the leaders, and now you're consolidating control. This ended the kind of intimacy, flexibility, and depth that came with home Bible studies and frustrated home group facilitators. So this was a big problem. And then the clothing ministry ends up, they end that. They do things like create a quota system for the praise and worship music so that they don't have too many white singers up there. So now they're benching white singers. So this just gets a lot of people upset. And people start leaving McLean Bible Church during these changes, ultimately reducing the size of the church by as much as half. Platt also replaced the church's core leadership. So people who disagreed with the changes and so forth, they were kind of put to the side. Craig Pruhl said that the staff members who disagreed with the new direction were either cut out or forced to leave. Michael Russell Lynch, who had been at the church for 2 decades and led the Discovering the Word community group, reported that every member of the old guard was deposed and replaced with Platt's proxies. So guys like Nathan Reed, Todd Peters, Britton Taylor, Eric Saunders, Mike Kelsey, Joe Carter, and Wade Burnett gain more prominence. And these guys all have SBC connections. Some of them have overtly social justice type connections that rub people wrong. Mike Kelsey talked about wanting to torch all white people, especially white Christians. You had, Saunders saying that comparing gender dysphoria to the hypostatic union, really weird stuff. And then after doing all these things, that's when people really start to get upset. These changes are going on at the church. And so this needs to end. Maybe it's that SBC thing. Maybe it's the fact that David Platt's here. He's different. He's affiliating us with the SBC. And that's where this junk is coming from. So during a congregational meeting on March 31st of, I think this is, what year? What year is this? You have to go back in the article to find out what year I'm talking about. I think this is 2021. Church member Laura Burke questioned Platt about NBC's affiliation with the Southern Baptist Convention. Platt evaded the question, prompting Laura's husband Jeremiah to present evidence of the church's ties to the SBC and then to dismiss Platt as pastor for violating the church's non-denominational constitution and lying about it. Now, this becomes the big issue. Jeremiah's microphone was turned off. He was escorted out by security. And then Lucius Thompson, the head of security, attributed Jeremiah's actions to a broader mental health crisis affecting the nation. Yet less than 2 weeks later, Platt asked SBC Executive Committee Representative Ashley Clayton to send a letter to his elders clarifying that NBC was not part of the denomination. So now you have David Platt coordinating with the SBC to try to, uh, for the SBC to see the church as not part of the denomination. They were part, they're not part. A lot of games going on. On June 30th, the church held a vote to confirm three potential elders whom David Platt wanted on the board. Because of the issues that I just described, the confirmation vote failed to reach the 75% threshold. Instead of accepting the results and electing a new elder board the church constitution required in such a case, Platt decided to hold a second election on July 18th. So you don't get the outcome you want, you just hold another election. This time the results were manipulated through the use of an open ballot, meaning that everyone knew how people voted. It wasn't a secret ballot anymore, so there's pressure now. And this time they were manipulated. Four hundred members were purged from the rolls without notification, including Chuck Wright, whose family helped found NBC with 25 members in 1961. So you have people showing up to vote and they're not members anymore somehow, or not voting members at least. These developments combined with intimidation tactics such as sending accusatory disfellowshipping letters and avoiding former members who wanted clarification about their status. And this wound up in Fairfax General District Court. The lawsuit alleged that the church's relationship with the Southern Baptist Convention was a violation of their church's constitution. McLean Bible Church spent $1 million approximately to block the lawsuit or get it dismissed, but their attempts failed. And attorney Chap Peterson noted that once we got the information, it was a matter of getting it out to the public. That will be the victory in this case. So that you could consider that a win for the McLean contingent that was dissatisfied or upset about this affiliation. They just wanted to get their discovery and their depositions and stuff out there, which is what happened. And that became the basis for this documentary. It was from the discovery in this case that my editor and I worked on this documentary. And then the Church Reform Initiative was formed out of this. Some of the people involved in it, namely the Burks, but others as well, decided, you know what, we want to help other churches that are going through this. It's such a nightmare if you've ever been through something like this. And so they have a heart to keep that from happening. And they decided to help in the situation at Faith Baptist Knightdale. Now, this documentary, part one and part two have come out. Part three is not out yet, but that had just dropped within the last few weeks. And this is one of the saddest ones. I mean, everything's sad. All of them are sad. But this is a very, really sad one because this one's not a mega church. Not that it makes it easier in every way, but it is a David and Goliath story. You have a church that's, I think, around 350 people. It was started. There's a redemption to this one, though, by the way. There's an element of this that's really encouraging. It was started in, I think, 1987, or I think the building was 1989. But the original pastor, this is so cool, I can't really stop myself from sharing this, but the original pastor who planted the church at first, he is now the current pastor of the church. He left in the early 90s and he came back to after the whole ordeal I'm about to describe, and he's the current pastor. His name's Mick Bowen. Or sorry, was it Mick? No, not Mick Bowen. Mick Bowen already resigned. Williams. Williams is the name of the pastor. Gary Williams. So he is now the pastor and he was the founding pastor. So things came full circle for him. But the way this story goes is that, again, same formula. You have a pastor leaving, Mick Bowen, who had been there for years, personable, wrote a card, a birthday card to every member of the congregation when they had a birthday. It was, you know, real small town, Norman Rockwell type feel to his church. And they get this pastor from Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary who is affiliated somehow, or he knows somehow along the line, he knows about Greer. He was, I think, a NAM church planner out in Colorado. So he ends up becoming the pastor, and he's got some new ideas in his head. He's got this formula in his head for what things need to be. And Faith Baptist Knightdale, another, by the way, non-denominational church, also has a stipulation in their constitution that you can't affiliate with the denomination. That's also part of the problem here. They were this very typical kind of Americana church, traditional, all of that. And it all started to change when Little took the reins. Little, like J.D. Greer, saw pastoral duty as first to the kingdom of God and then to the local church. From Little's perspective, Faith Baptist needed to fundamentally change if it were to accomplish its mission. Under his direction, the church engaged a church growth consulting firm, the Unstuck Group. So now you have the consultation at significant cost to observe and make recommendations. And so he starts getting rid of all these ministries. So they get rid of the choir and the orchestra. The choir is known in the community as this really great choir. It's gone. And they replace it with a contemporary rock band setup. Get rid of, you know, the people who played on it for years, like Bill Ifland and his wife Ruth, who played piano and trombone. Now there's no place for them. And the other ministries, like Morning Sunday School, was deposed in favor of quote unquote life groups. The seniors group was gotten rid of. The children's program, Awana, Vacation Bible School, a quilting ministry. These things. Now, here's the thing. I was thinking about this. Some of these innovative ideas for remaking a church. Maybe, and I'm not saying you could even justify it in because of this, but maybe you could say in an urban environment or even some suburban environments, maybe some of this makes sense. But this stuff is making its way out to rural areas, small town churches. I don't think it makes sense even in an urban environment at all. But I'm just saying, even if it did, it's not suited for these things, but it becomes the formula. It becomes like just what you got to do. And so they get rid of these legacy ministries. And that gets rid of, people start leaving. Same thing that happened at McLean. And the church became more casual, noticeably sterile. Pastor Little opted for jeans, sneakers, and an untucked shirt instead of a traditional suit. The American and Christian flags were removed. You know, it's distracting from Christ or offensive or intimidating people from different cultures. So you got a woke element here. The Children's Ministry Center, once designed to resemble a small village, complete with a mock garage and movie theater, was stripped bare at a cost of $43,000. Nearly every room in the building was cleared of furniture, appliances, and equipment. The roof was repainted, the walls were repainted, and they all matched Summit's office gray, bland office gray. It's like when the McDonald's started looking like Starbucks. That's what they did to this church. And I want to show you this picture. If you watch the documentary, you can see all of this. But if you, let's see here, where is it? It's here it is, right here. Check this out. Faith Baptist, this is the hallway, I think, leading into the children's area. That's what it looked like before. This is what it looked like after. Look how sterile it is. That's what they did to the whole building. I mean, they erased the church's identity and made it just this bland kind of office. Like you're walking into a bank. And it's just, you know, it's modernity. That's what it is. So anyway, they wiped our identity from the building, according to Matthew Holder, who did the grounds and maintenance there. But the church lost more than just the character of its building. Hundreds of members left when the music director was canned, Sean Bradshaw. You had all these people leave. They retired. They replaced him with like this 22-year-old guy who played guitar. And it's just the whole thing was just modernized and updated, but not in a good way. And beginning in 2023, a majority of the men on the leadership team were part of Pastor Little's inner circle. So he consolidated power, got rid of those who would oppose him. He went through this phase of like putting people on committees, and some of them were confused as to why they were on these committees, but it was to, it seems like later, to gain approval, because he would then say so-and-so is on this committee and they're a respectable member of the church, as if they must agree with what the committee was doing. But the committees were being controlled. So he consolidated control, got rid of potential opposing factors, announced that the church was facing a financial crisis. That was the next step. And this is where it gets interesting. This one's a little different in this sense, because on December 10th of 2023, John Wallace, a church treasurer, detailed that he alleged were 8 years of massive losses, citing for $144,000 in deficits in 2016, and then each year since then. And all these massive deficits. Now, a few of the members caught it when they saw this, that the graphs made no sense, that they were pie charts, but the figures didn't add up. The former treasurer for the church said that there wasn't any truth to the numbers that were presented, but they presented these numbers apparently to presumably create the conditions for a crisis, that we got to do something drastic here. And they, through the month of October, asked for suggestions. People are trying to give suggestions. In fact, found out later there was someone from the Spanish church that they had there who had agreed to, it was a crazy amount. It was like $400,000 or something to give to the church to help them with their debts, and wasn't even presented to the church, right? Because that wasn't the point. The point was they wanted to merge the with J.D. Greer's church that already has, I think, 12 different satellite campuses. They wanted the building and the grounds that probably are worth around $25 million to go to Summit Church. And this would be Summit Church's You'd have a screen there. So J.D. Greer would be preaching from a screen. It would be so different than what these people are used to. And that's what they were going to do. And so rumors have been circulating that Jason Little intended to sell the summit. And so this becomes people all of a sudden who before were trying to just kind of go along and maybe, you know, they respect the pastor like they do at a traditional church, were all of a sudden saying, no, you're not going to get rid of our church. And the way it was presented was, well, it's a merger. But really what it was a dissolution. That's what they were actually going to vote on, a dissolution. And so so what ends up happening is plans were set in motion to effectively dissolve Faith Baptist Church and transfer its assets to Summit. This was repeatedly framed as a merger, like I said. Pastor J.D. Greer was excited about the opportunity and recorded a video to be shown at Faith Baptist ahead of the proposed merger in which he sought to ease concerns about going from a smaller church with a preaching pastor to a mega church campus with a video-based preaching. Finally, on January 21st, 2024, Jason Little formally announced to the congregation that church leadership planned to merge with Summit. And J.D. Greer, I'll mention this first. Some members had stopped receiving church communications after being reclassified as inactive. So it's kind of similar tactics to the McLean story, a designation never previously used in the church's history. There was also growing opposition among members to relinquishing the church's preschool, which Summit intended to close once the merger was finalized. So they're getting rid of the preschool now. It's there was one case where they found out in discovery, who was it? It was one of the guys who asked questions at a meeting, the meeting I just referenced with where the numbers were given in December 10th, where he was, let's see, it's in the article. I'm trying to look for it. See, I think it was Bill Ifland. Yeah, Bill Ifland. So he asked this question about to leadership, and it's the next day that he goes from active to inactive status. So it seems like what's going on is they are purging the church of those who would be potentially oppositional to this plan to quote unquote merge with Summit. Jason Little was seen giving Kivett Hicks, a pastor of Summit Church's Knightdale location, a tour of the student center. Even the parliamentarian overseeing the upcoming merger vote was paid by Summit. So now Summit is really starting to intertwine before the vote with the church. February 18th, J.D. Greer visited Faith Baptist for a one-hour meet and greet. That didn't go so well for him. He didn't make the impression he was hoping, I think. What concerned members most, though, was how Greer's handled difficult questions. Lloyd Murphy asked if Greer had a business-related interest in the merger, given the property's estimated value of around $25 million. Greer denied the claim, insisting it was about ministry, but a lot of people were unconvinced about this. Just before the vote on March 3rd, and after church leadership denied requests for mediation, that's key, by the way, the leadership was denied requests for mediation. The whole idea, like, oh, you're, you know, because this was one of the arguments that David Gibbs gave in court was, the church requires you to actually adjudicate matters without going to court. Christians shouldn't take each other to court. Well, mediation's denied. So what recourse do they have? And now Caesar's already being welcomed into the church because they're bringing policemen in to monitor the vote. So Caesar was brought in from the guys who are in leadership at the church, at Faith Baptist, and the Summit contingent. Just before the vote, Defenders of the Faith, that's the group's name, filed a lawsuit and a motion for a temporary restraining order. And it's because they're seeing all that. They're seeing that about 25 to 30 proxy votes were taken that night of the vote. They eventually saw 183 members have been moved to the inactive list, including people. I got a picture here. I got this guy named Gerald Hayes. And by the way, I don't even think Gerald's. This is the thing with this stuff, by the way. This isn't just like a political, it's not just a right-left thing. You got guys who, they're not looking at this from a political standpoint. They just want their church. And most of them are like that. But Gerald Hayes was one of these guys. Like, he shows up to vote. He's been a member there for years. Vietnam vet, salt of the earth kind of guy. And they're just saying there's nothing they can do. He can't vote. He's like, I've been at every church service. And he was just moved to the inactive list. And he wasn't even part of the original lawsuit, but he ends up testifying, and it becomes a very powerful testimony that allows the lawsuit to move forward. By the way, this lawsuit, I think the lawyer had told me, James Lawrence, that this had like a 75% chance of failing or something. And they won. They just kept winning, which is another kind of redemptive aspect of the story. I mean, God is in control ultimately. And, you know, Summit looked like they were in a good position to get this church and they didn't. So, anyway, the vote happens and then, but the lawsuit ends up getting eventually a preliminary injunction on the vote. So they can't use that mechanism to merge or quote unquote have the dissolution and the takeover from Summit. And so then the next step is, see if I want to skip ahead here. There's some other details I give that are somewhat intriguing about the defense and the court dramatics and so forth. But then on April 23rd, Jason Little and JD, oh, this is one of the things that keeps happening. So Faith Leadership was ready to resign and allow the congregation to elect new leaders. Okay, uncle, you got us. But then April 23rd, Jason Little and JD Greer have a conversation. And while the details remain unclear, the following day, John Wallace, who is on the leadership team at Little's church at Faith Baptist, he consults with a bankruptcy lawyer. And then on May 10th, Faith Baptist filed for bankruptcy in federal court in the Eastern District of North Carolina, which froze all state court action. So if you file in federal court, whatever state court action is happening, that freezes, that doesn't continue, and you have to resolve the federal issue. Well, if it's bankruptcy, then they're going to have Summit get the church in a bankruptcy action. So they file bankruptcy. On the same day they file bankruptcy, Summit Church injects $170,000 into Faith Baptist to supposedly, this is their language, to advance the gospel in Knightdale. Now, think about this. This is at a time when the church was shutting down all remaining ministries. Clearly, a good portion of this money is going to legal expense. This isn't about the gospel in Knightdale. The church is filing for bankruptcy, and on the same day, they get $170,000 from the church that's going to take all their assets once the bankruptcy is complete. Interesting, right? So they have so many resources. It really is a David and Goliath thing. And the Defenders of the Faith group is like, they're going into debt. They're scraping the bottom of the barrel just to save their church. And they started meeting in the former children's building. Then the church gets locked. And then they start meeting in the outdoor pavilion. And then there's trespassing signs that get put up. And they start meeting in the youth building or the student center because the Spanish church invites them to come. And then the church doesn't renew their contract with the Spanish church. So you have now a tenant who's paying money. And you're supposedly in bankruptcy, and now they're not going to pay money anymore. We're not going to let them on our property. So obviously the bankruptcy thing has to be a farce. It was later revealed that a member, so I said this before, $400,000 the Spanish church member had offered, and they never even told the church about it. So this was about trying to get Summit to make this a satellite campus in their empire there in Raleigh, Durham. And it was like the bankruptcy stuff. There were solutions here to help alleviate whatever problem there might have been, and they weren't taken, obviously. As the legal proceedings continued, Summit's strategy shifted. A deposition of J.D. Greer was scheduled at 10 a.m. on December 4th. Summit Church filed a motion to prevent Greer's deposition from being shared on social media. So they're interested. They don't want publicly people to see what Greer was going to say in that deposition. But the judge rejected the request. The day before the deposition, the parties settled the dispute. What could have ended in disaster became a beautiful ending. Like I said, Gary Williams comes back and he's a pastor. Now, this is very interesting to me. There's all kinds of intrigue and things. I mean, you got, before the preliminary injunction, there is, I think it was before that, there's a court order to basically to pause the results moving forward with the quote unquote merger. And this is something like the leaders of even the Summit who are involved in this are kind of like, well, you know, it's, if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But there's this email where I think it was Kivett Hicks says J.D. Greer is in fight mode. So he wants this property, he wants this church. He's in fight mode. He's willing to go to war with these guys who want to keep their church. And the narrative is that this was the will of the majority of the church. Of course, that gets thrown out, though, because of the shady tactics they use. And it was only 8 votes, by the way. So supposedly, if you run their numbers, right, by 8 votes, the church votes to merge with Summit. but you have to factor in the people who are denied a vote, the people who show up, who are just recently there because they're coming from Summit, the votes that they take through phone calls to people that are favorable to their cause. So these are the kinds of things that happen. And the whole thing is spun as like, oh, no, the majority of the church just wanted this. It was this disgruntled group that didn't want it. And that's I think, if you hear any response from Greer or any of those guys, that's what they're going to say. But don't buy it. It's a bunch of hogwash. So anyway, throughout the entire saga, two things stood out. The first was the sense of entitlement some church leaders, including pastors, displayed, believing they could get away without considering the impact on their congregation. Messages between key players revealed a general expectation that people would simply fall in line with their plans. For example, comments like Kivett Hicks saying, "I'm in for blasting away at the chairs." The chairs that were remaining church members were using, you know, to meet out under the pavilion. There were other things too, by the way, like especially between Kivett Hicks and Jason Little. Kivett Hicks being the Summit Church of Knightdale pastor, like things like making fun of people's the way they talk, and just like there's just inappropriate humor, in my opinion, between pastors, and such a display of not, you know, it's kind of disgusting. You see these messages, these text messages, and these emails, which I've read, and it's like these guys are saying, "Oh, I'm praying for you. It's like the devil's attacking. So I'm just praying for you. God's in control." And then the way they speak about these members of the flock, they're supposed to be helping these people, and they view them as such enemies, such condescension. And I'm not impressed with any of these guys. I'm so not impressed with Jason Little. I mean, the guy's preaching canned sermons. Kivett Hicks, even J.D. Greer, like these guys, outside, in my opinion, outside of the bubble that they're in, these aren't impressive people, but they really think a lot of themselves. And that's the disgusting part of all of it. Like, they just really think a lot of themselves, and it comes out in these messages. Anyway, there were less from Greer. Greer's more like, you know, he shows up because people are talking about what he said or relaying what he thinks. I think Greer mostly is going to, he works through surrogates. And I think if there's any response to this, by the way, it's going to be through surrogates, because Greer can't, he can't really say much about it. I'll show you. He's already said, I think, things about this, but it's in these, like, these general ways. He's not going to come at it specifically. So I'll show you what he even said last Sunday. But anyway, I assessed this whole situation, and this is my assessment. Local churches are meeting the managerial revolution. What do you mean by that, John? What's the managerial revolution? Well, think about it this way. When you go to town to get hardware or something, where do you go? Do you go to Lowe's or do you go to a local hardware store? When you want to get produce, do you go to a local farm market or do you go to some kind of like Walmart or something? When you want to buy clothes, do you go to a corporation or is there, you know, are there any other options? And we see this in business. We see the corporatism. We see the people in politics and entertainment and influential sectors in our a society, they're managerial elites, and they will jump from in their social strata, they'll jump from one industry to another, and they don't, you know, they find a soft place to land almost always because they're protected by the guild. And this is James Burnham's thesis that during FDR, it wasn't socialism, it was managerialism. And I think he's right about that. But managerialism has really come to the church now, and specifically now the evangelical church. If there was one place in the community you could go to that wasn't under some kind of market-driven or corporate management, that was actually just a real virtuous leader who went through the right ranks, was respectable, you knew the guy, and you could walk in and it's real, it's tangible. The people around you are a real community. It's not all gimmicky. It's not just one size fits all universal. It's specific. It's unique. It's something you could be proud of and take ownership in and have a place of belonging in. So if there was one place like that left, it was probably your local church, your local Baptist church that still looked the way it did in 1985. That still sang some of the songs they did in 1985. It still had people walking in, maybe even still with nicer looks like ties and tucked in shirts. Well, that's all gone. That's all gone. That's what this is. That's what this is about. It is now erasing that. So you have no options. You will go to some kind of globalist type, or national or global universal type of market, subject to market forces institution. And it's going to be under managers, people that aren't that impressive, but they have the right connections. And they know how to manipulate. I mean, it's a bunch of foxes. It gatekeeps out the lions. Bunch of sly, conniving type people who have their formulas and strategies. Not the people who are in touch with the real. I mean, Jason Little, like David Platt had the same problem, right? Jason Little just disappears after the service, according to his congregants. I've been at churches like that where the pastor just disappears. You can never get to know him because he's just gone. I guess he's like a preaching robot or something. Like that's what he does, I guess. That's not a pastor. Pastors shepherd the flock. And, you know, David Platt did the same kind of thing. You have this security guard even saying, like, look, I just try to get a meeting with him for 15 minutes. I can't even do it. No one can access the guy. He doesn't do counseling. He just gets there and preaches and doesn't even do it every Sunday. And that's his job. And like, what is that? And that's what Jason Little was doing. He's like preaching two times a month, canned sermons. So now I mean by canned, apparently he was getting... You could look up his sermons and find them online, is what I'm saying. So that was at least what I was told. So, all right. So there were social justice themes present, but it seems like this is more than just social justice. And the pattern is clear. Install new church leadership with ties to larger institutions bent on revolutionizing the church. Centralized control among loyalists, hire outside experts to reinforce the vision. Erase the church's prior identity. Push the new agenda rapidly and silence dissent. And if you see any of this happening at your church, you better fight. That's my encouragement to you. You better fight because you're about to possibly endure hostile takeover. You know, and I've had so many people reach out to me now, and I'm like, look, I can't help unless there are people at the church. You have to help yourself, right? There's a lot of churches that go through this. The vast majority that go through this, you never hear a thing about it. In fact, the Unstuck Group, James Tomberlin, who's in charge of that, claims that nearly 40% of multi-site churches expand through mergers or building acquisitions, meaning they're not planting and starting from scratch. They find a church already in existence and merge with it or take the assets of a church. That's 40%, according to him. It's a pretty high number that now that, you know, the church is just go and watch church on a screen, I guess. Really sad to me. So that's... it's a standardized universal approach. It's the formulaic approach, and it's about imposing that formula. So that's the article I wrote. Now, I told you I would get to some reactions here, okay? I'm going to do that now. Here is from last Sunday. This is J.D. Greer, and this is what he had to say from the pulpit. Well, they don't have a pulpit, so what? From the stage? It's a stage. It's a show. Yeah, from the stage of... the Summit Church.
Who say that they're Jews, and they're not, but they're actually a synagogue of Satan. Jews were supposed to be God's people, and yet they turned out in Smyrna to be the biggest persecutors of the believers there. And what Jesus is saying to this early church is, hey, those look like my people, but they're not. Honestly, y'all, I think the hardest thing for me to reckon with has not been persecution from those outside the church. The hardest thing has always been persecution that comes from within the church. When criticism or persecution comes from outside the church, I mean, I expect that, right? And by the way, can I just say this real quick? I don't like using the word persecution to describe what we go through here in light of what our brothers and sisters from the Middle East and Russia have to deal with. Getting lied about on social media is not the same thing as them going to prison and having their kids taken away from them. I think we should probably save the word persecution for them, okay? But still, the pain caused by friendly fire has probably been the hardest for me. Some of you have experienced that with friends and family. People you thought would understand and support you in your walk with Jesus and encourage you, they're the ones that became your biggest critics. I always have to remind myself that Jesus' crucifixion was a joint project between the secular establishment on the left and the religious establishment on the right. The true gospel of Jesus ends up offending both of them, and both of them attack the gospel from different sides. See, the gospel offends the secular left by saying that Jesus is Lord of our bodies, for example, that you just can't decide for yourself what your personal rules are for sexual orientation or gender or marriage and calling that pride. The gospel challenges the secular left when it says that all human life is sacred. You can't just discard a human life in the womb because it's become inconvenient to you. The gospel offends the religious establishment on the right, however, when it tells us that we should be filled with grace and generosity, that we should respond to our secular leaders with submission and honor whenever we can. It challenges the religious establishment on the right when it says that we Christians are responsible not only for our own needs, but that God holds us responsible for the needs of others around us, even our enemies. It offends us when it tells us that God wants us to love the immigrant and the stranger and the vulnerable and to treat their needs like we would our own. Hear me, friend, if you are living in step with the gospel, you will make enemies of both the secular left and the religious right. And I'm not trying to say that left and right are equally evil or depraved. They're not. I'm just saying that the true gospel ends up offending them both. Notice verse 9, Jesus says these Jews were the synagogue of Satan. People who were supposed to be God's representatives are actually now the instruments of Satan. You see, Satan has two tactics. He opposes the church from the outside in the form of Caesar's persecution. He also does it from the inside from those who say they worship God. Again, never forget this. Jesus' opposition, Jesus' crucifixion was a joint project of secular left and religious right. And if you and I are going to stand with him on our day, you should expect opposition from both directions also.
Well, that was ridiculous on I don't know how many levels, a bunch of them. Let me outline a few that just came to mind. Number one, he gets the gospel wrong. That's pretty a serious error, in my opinion, but that's what he did. Notice what he says. He says that the gospel, he kept saying gospel. The gospel offends the secular left and the secular right. And then he immediately breaks out into ethics talk, law talk, right? So because Christians believe in the sanctity of human life, that means that's the gospel offending the left. No, that's the law of God offending the left. It's not the gospel offending the left. So there's that. I feel like a broken clock because it's just that error comes up so often, conflating the law and the gospel. But pretty basic error there. And then the other thing is, obviously, yeah, I would say he improved at least by not drawing a comparison that he admitted that this was not exactly parallel, so that he doesn't say which is worse, right or left, but he at least says they're not necessarily equal in their moral evil, but that he implies that if you're a true Christian who really has the gospel, you'll be attacked by the right and the left. That's just, that's what happens. And what's he talking about there, though? Why does he jump into that? Because this is an assumption here, but he obviously was trying to make sense, right? Because he's preaching to a congregation and they're in a specific situation. He's trying to tell them something, not nothing, right? So what's he trying to tell them? Well, he's saying you have enemies who come from within. Okay. True. That's what enemies within the church was about. So you have enemies coming from within, which I would say, like Nathan the prophet, you demand, JD, but and when they oppose, they lie on social media. That's apparently one of the things they do. They lie about Summit Church on social media. And then we also get attacked by not just the left, but the right as well. Well, so three things that fit this situation. I think if you're thinking about it wrongly, but if you're trying to reference the Nightdale situation, it's an attack I'm sure they would conceive of as from the right. It is on social media, and it's from within. So this is prepping the audience to, I think at least that's probably what's going on here. I'm speculating, so I'm not accusing, but I'm assuming that that's probably what he's talking about there. But I think that's all you're probably going to get from J.D. Greer, to be honest with you, at least at this point. He apparently made a similar statement a few weeks ago. To come out and acknowledge it, so the more you talk about this issue, the more eyeballs you're going to get on it. Because actually, let me go right now. If I go, and this is just the YouTube version, there's versions on X. I don't even know where all the versions are, but the YouTube version, let's see. Church Reform Initiative. All right. I want to see how many views. Episode one has almost 200,000 views right now. So, let's see if I can show it to you. There it is. So that's a lot, for, especially for a smaller YouTube channel. That's a lot. And this is a big local story too. So if I'm JD Greer, what do I do? How do I, if I mention it, people are going to go watch it and it's indefensible. The only other thing he can do probably is act through surrogates. He can try to attack, you know, you can't really attack the victims, right? So you could try to, like, I guess, attack, you know, it would be dumb probably for him to do it, because then it's also going to drive my numbers up and stuff. But you could try to attack me. But I didn't have, honestly, I had nothing to do with it except for the fact that I listened to the stories and someone filmed them. That was pretty much it. I probably interviewed half the people in this one. So I listened to some of the stories, and I didn't financially gain anything from any of this. The only thing I asked Church Reform Initiative, actually, I didn't even ask them. They just, I think, did it. But in this case, I don't even ask for my travel expenses to be paid for, but I think they gave me a reimbursement for travel or something. That was it. So I didn't make any money off of it. It's not my baby. This belongs to the people at the church. And Church Reform Initiative didn't get anything for this either. All they do is pay. They just want to tell the stories of these people. You have to look these people in the eye if you're going to handle it in a serious way that anyone's going to take seriously. And you have to contradict them. You have to say what happened in discovery didn't actually happen. What happened in court didn't actually happen. What happened to these people didn't actually happen. And you can't do it. You can't watch the documentary and then come away with that. So he's in a real bind. If there's any response, it's probably going to be working through surrogates. It's going to be, Baptist Press or the Tennessean or the Houston Chronicle or Religion News Service. It's going to be one of those outlets that has a reporter who supposedly is unbiased, who will come through and justify JD Greer without doing anything to actually justify him. That's the only way that they have. And even that is only going to be a tactic that will, I think, ease their conscience maybe, and help save face with friends. It's not going to help the people who actually know the facts and watch the documentary and dig into the discovery, which, as I understand it, will be available. So there you go. The best thing to do is just to apologize, just to humble yourself and say, we done messed up big time. And we want to issue a public apology to Faith Baptist Knightdale and how we treated that situation. That's the only Christian option here. But do you think that's going to happen? I doubt it. Here was David Platt, by the way. Now, I played a clip, it's getting late, so I don't think I'll play it. But I did play a clip a few weeks back of David Platt lying, essentially. Maybe I'll play it. Here it is. This was maybe 2 or 3 months ago at the Gospel Coalition. So David Platt, this is what he said about the McLean documentary. The details.
There was one point in some of the challenges we walked through in our church a few years ago that was particularly traumatizing, involving somebody coming at me physically with police coming after them, and thankfully was able to get out of that situation. But the next morning, my wife and I were in a small gathering of brothers and sisters in Christ, many of whom I didn't personally know, and at one point, somebody I did know asked the group to pray over my wife, Heather, and me. So we got on our knees, and they started praying over us. And as that time began to conclude, I hear the voice of a sister in Christ on the other side of the room. And she began to speak. She said, "I don't know you guys. I don't know anything about what you're walking through. Why we're even praying for you." Like nothing. She had no context. And she definitely didn't know what had happened.
Let me summarize it for you for the sake of time. Basically, David Platt gets all emotional about, He was almost assaulted by someone who comes up to him, and it traumatized him. That's the word he uses, traumatizing. It was Laura Burke. It's in the documentary. I think it's in part two of the McLean, the Real David Platt documentary. You can see it. You can see what happens. And she comes up to him, and the police are after her. Well, yeah, she's got her three kids there. Real intimidating, David Platt, real traumatizing. But then he's in this situation with this lady who has no context, just doesn't know anything, but just gives him a word from the Lord that's just so impactful, and he's weeping. And then weeks later, someone else comes who's a visitor to the church, or no, someone visits the church and then sends him a message, and he gets it. And they're just like, "You had some traumatic experience a few weeks back, didn't you? God loves you." And it's so female coded, the whole thing. But basically what it is, I think it's just a big lie, to be quite honest with you. It's David Platt, first of all, saying he was traumatized, give me a break. And then saying that these people apparently had this access to these people he doesn't know, have access to him, to pray for him. And this is the guy that his security guard can't even get a 15-minute meeting with. He doesn't do counseling. He disappears. But all of a sudden, these people he doesn't know are, I mean, like, I'd love to see that message he's talking about, you know? I don't know how he'd prove that this meeting took place, but I'd love to see proof that any of this happened. So that was the first thing I heard him say publicly regarding this situation. Well, then you have him recently on Ruslan's podcast. Now, the title of the podcast was David Platt Breaks the Silence About Everything, or something like that. And so I started listening to it because I'm like, okay, like this is like over an hour long. David Platt must really get into granular detail because I don't even know what he can say. It's so damning. This is basically the only substantive thing he said about the situation. You ready?
To the broader church body and in these disagreements. And ultimately, this stuff was done legally. Mm. All the lawsuits were dismissed. Mm. And a lot of the stuff that was hurled wasn't accurate. Mm.
Yeah.
Okay, let's stop right there. Ruslan is wrong from the beginning. The lawsuits were all dismissed. No, there's one that's ongoing right now, actually. So it can't be dismissed. The other one, like I described to you, so the one that's ongoing right now is about church membership and those who are denied church active status. The one that was that ended, that we obtained discovery from in order to do the documentary, that particular one did not end in McLean's favor. So Ruslan just said something that's totally untrue. The lawsuits were all dismissed. Does David Platt correct him? Nope. I mean, that would be a convenient lie, wouldn't it? But David Platt doesn't correct him. Just lets Ruslan keep talking. And as if McLean apparently just ran the tables in court. And these people just said there was nothing of merit to their complaints. Well, that's bald-faced lie on the face of it. But David Platt just lets it happen.
I would say, one, like, don't be surprised. Like, this is, it's opened my eyes in a fresh way. There's nobody in this book who followed God, Jesus, and didn't experience, from Nehemiah to Paul and everywhere in between. Like, don't be surprised. Where did I ever get the idea that this was going to be easy? Like, the more you press in, and that's where I would encourage, like, again, to the extent of which, like, it's clear and direct in God's word. Like, keep pressing in there, knowing it's going to be challenging, knowing you're going to have things hurled at you. Like, but I mean, I spent a lot of time with brothers and sisters around the world who experience far worse than anything I've experienced when it comes to attacks. Mm-hmm. And they're persevering. Like, yes, this is what we do. But we, at the same time, I do think we have to guard against the temptation to just kind of shrink back then. Okay, so it's a lot easier if you don't talk about justice, if you just kind of skirt the whole issue. So it's going to be costly to talk about justice. So work hard to make sure what you're saying about justice is you can show, like, clear and direct, is in God's word. You can stand before God, like, I'm leading based on what your word says. But just know it's going to be costly. It's going to be a harder road to step into some of these issues. But it's worth it if you're holding fast to God's word. So I wrote a book somewhere in the middle of all this over the last couple of years, Don't Hold Back. But the whole idea was, like, yeah, don't, it'd be easier just to shrink back and not, to avoid some of the criticism or the challenges, but step into and trust that God's going to be faithful.
Sounds a lot like J.D. Greer referencing persecuted Christians overseas, our brothers and sisters overseas. But you see how they're doing that. It's, you reference them but you compare yourself to them as if, well, they're what they're going through so much, but you're putting yourself in the same category as them. That's the sneaky thing that Greer and Platt are both doing, that they're putting themselves they're undergoing the same kind of thing, just not to the same intensity. So they have people persecuting them. And in this case, it's the Church Reform Initiative folks, right? That he's being persecuted. And apparently it's because of his stand for justice, right? He's just doing the same thing from Nehemiah to Paul. It's the same thing Jesus did. That's what he's doing. Platt's just preaching it. J.D. Greer's just preaching the gospel. You should be expect to see persecution when you preach the gospel. They're just preaching Christianity, and woe and behold, all of a sudden these people lawyer up and sue them or take them to court and have these issues. Well, those cases at McLean had nothing to do with David Platt preaching justice, quote unquote. And Platt, he can't substantiate, he thinks disparities mean injustice, and he thinks that the crowd at T4G is not being true to the gospel because it's too white. I mean, he forget about him being careful to make sure the text says what it says. He doesn't do that. But what he's trying to do is tell you that he's just being biblically faithful, and he's experiencing a little bit, just a touch of what our brothers and sisters overseas experience. It's stolen valor. It's stolen virtue. It's lies. It's letting Ruslan frame it the way he did. It's just terrible. And that's what these people do. They are very good at deceiving. I will give them that. And they probably self-deceive, which is why they're good at it. They probably legitimate. That was one of the things that struck me in reading some of the Discovery stuff is like, man, these people really do think that God's on their side. They really do think that what they're doing here is right, or at least they have some veneer of Christianity they're laying over it. But the way they talk about the people that they should be caring for is abysmal. So I thought I'd point that out. It's kind of a disgusting thing Platt's doing there. No, what you're going through is actually more than justified, David Platt and J.D. Greer, because you guys not only did you disrupt a church, you tried to fundamentally take a church away from the people it belonged to, from the people who actually were salt of the earth members of the church. And you denied, you ended up becoming complicit in denying them votes, denying them the ability to actually stand up for their church. And you behaved in ways that were deceptive. Is deceptive even the word? I mean, illegal. You ended up going against the very church constitutions that you're trying to, these churches that you're supposedly trying to help. You're violating their constitutions by affiliating with either a church in a denomination or a denomination directly. Not to mention the political social justice stuff, but to me, to then come around and claim, yeah, you know, I was in fight mode and I put $160,000 into a church that just declared bankruptcy, supposedly to spread the gospel in Knightdale, when it was really going to pay lawyers' fees to combat the very people that wanted to get the church back. It's terrible. There's no words for it. It's just awful. It's a sick thing to do. And then to turn around and be like, well, you know, our brothers and sisters are also persecuted overseas, and it's kind of like what we're going through, but obviously much worse overseas. No, it's not even in the same class. You guys are despicable people. That's really what's going on here. You're despicable people, and you don't even see it. You're so blind to your own sin in these things. You're fine herding sheep, causing them pain. The spiritual ramifications of this. You literally have churches that were influential in their communities, that had robust ministries, choirs and clothing and quilting and car care was Naples. Just all kinds of ways that they were reaching the community. And then it's all disrupted. The impact of the church, it's an embarrassment. The reputation of Christ is sullied in these kinds of things. You have people leaving the church in large numbers who were the core, who were involved good for years, in some cases, founding members who were, you know, there's one thing that there's obviously times when there are problem people that need to go from a church and the truth will chase them away. But that's not every time. And in this situation, it's just going in there and taking what another man with Christ's it's really what Christ built, but with what Christ used another man to help build, the labors of these seasoned pastors, it's taking what they did and then train wrecking it. And the impact all those ministries had, diminishing it. And then for your formula, and then turning around and being like, well, I'm being persecuted. You had an opportunity to settle this. You didn't have to even go to court. Greer didn't have to go to court. Maybe, I mean, who knows? I mean, maybe he would have been able to settle outside of court. They rejected mediation. So what are you going to do? Like, it's the whole thing to me. It's just bonkers. It's absolutely bonkers. The fact that these guys can sleep at night on their pillows. I do not want to be standing next to them in a lightning storm. I do not want to be standing next to them on Judgment Day. I don't want anything to do with them. There's only one hope. And honestly, unfortunately for these guys, it would be repenting. It would have to be public. And they'd have to step down. That's it. That's the only way, because they've been so, what they've done is so egregious. A lot of projection too. Like what they say seems like it describes them. You guys are the enemies within. You guys are the ones coming into churches and destabilizing them. Yeah, and then it's just, I don't know if it's the millennial generation. I don't know what it is. We can, it seems like people are experts in my generation and maybe those younger to some extent at making themselves out victimizing others. Like we always got the deck stacked against us. We're always the victim in these things. You know, Platt and Greer are the aggressors in all of this. Greer's in fight mode, but apparently he's the one that's being beaten up on. No, I'm sorry. You were in fight mode. You were the one that was the aggressor. I'll get to some comments now. The McLean Bible now is just another liberal church in the DMV area. Hey, David, we, NBC, didn't hold back time for you to resign along with Kelsey and Burnett. That's the, oh man, I'm getting so many comments here. That's the meta, John. We live in squeaky wheel world. Squeaky, I like that, squeaky wheel world. It's just hard to pronounce. Kim Traveler got, oh, that's sorry. I'm jumping into a conversation halfway here. What is the series on YouTube? The series, which one? I don't know. There's three of them. So you can go to YouTube. You can type in, you go to Enemies Within the Church and see the story of First Baptist Naples. You can then go and see at the Church Reform Initiative, both the David Platt documentary, which is called The Real David Platt, part one and two. And you can see part one and two of Fighting for Faith, the story of Faith Baptist Nightdale. Part three has not come out yet. It will, though. And I'm not telling you when. Did he just compare the left and right in 2025 to the religious leaders in Jerusalem and political leaders in Rome in Jesus' day? Yes, he did. Yes, that's what Platt did earlier. And that's another reason that the whole thing's bonkers. Like, what are you even doing? Like, as if they have, yeah, I guess the left in Jesus's day, the Romans were really offended by anti-homosexuality. Give me a break. Hi, Mama. Always said, if someone has a problem with you, maybe the problem is them, not you. But if everyone has the same problem with you, the problem is likely you. I wonder if JD needs to talk with Mama. It would probably help. All right, I'll only get to a few more questions or comments, and then I'll have to end the podcast here. Why aren't these guys held accountable by the SBC? That's a good question. The SBC, well, they are the SBC. That's part of the problem. David Platts was the director of the IMB. He's got connections. He's a rock star in the SBC. J.D. Greer was the president of the SBC for, I think, 3 years, right? And so he's very well connected. They are the SBC. They're not going to hold each other accountable. So, yeah, pretty good activity, Charles says, for a late night podcast. And I agree. It's 11:20 and we got almost 800 people streaming, which I wasn't expecting, and a lot of people in the chat. Let me sum it up for you this way. Let me just give you some encouragement here. Obviously, Christ is going to build his church. He said he would. There are virtuous leaders out there. They might be found more on lower levels than in these mega churches and big ministry conglomerates. I'm pretty convinced that that's where you're going to find the virtuous people. It's hard to find them the higher you get in these things, which is unfortunate. But I think that this, practically speaking, this is the time to try to, if you're in one of those big churches, there's already scaling issues with all of that and opportunities for corruption. Maybe consider a smaller church. Maybe consider getting involved at a scale in which you can actually know your pastor and be involved in ministry and not just be a spectator. That's my encouragement. And especially if you're going to a church with a screen, and that's so not optimal. The shepherd can't see you from a screen. He's not even preaching to you. He's preaching to a lens. Why don't you just stay home then? I mean, at that point, right? So I think we need to get back to actually what a true church is. I think these guys who are, again, they're managerial elites. This isn't pastoral leadership in any meaningful sense. This is managerialism. This is trying to create an empire and even using the stolen efforts of other men to try to boost what you have going. It's usurping all of, I mean, it's stealing churches, right? Some of this stuff. That's what it seems like. So it's the kind of man that wants to take shortcuts. It's not honorable. It's not masculine. It's not virtuous. It's underhanded. It's conniving. It's sly. These aren't the qualities that leaders should have. And so that's, I think, part of the problem. I mean, if you go to, let's see. I'm going to go to Titus here. Actually, I'll just go to 1 Timothy 3. I'll read for you. And just you see if this matches these guys. If anyone aspires to the office of overseer, he desires a noble task. An overseer must be above reproach. Are these guys above reproach? I mean, you know, you got whole documentaries documenting their sinful activity. The husband of one wife. I'll give them the benefit of the doubt on that. Sober-minded. I don't know. They've really made some bad decisions running their churches into financial icebergs with lawsuits here. Doesn't seem like very wise-like behavior. Self-controlled. I don't know. A self-controlled person is not they don't look at other people's stuff and then try to take it for themselves. They work for it. Respectable. Hospitable. You kind of have to be involved with people to be hospitable. I mean, that story about David Platt not even wanting to meet with his security guard to me, I keep bringing that up, but hospitable. Able to teach. I don't know. I don't think so. You look at J.D. Greer's. I remember with the whole docent controversy, right? I think, wasn't it J.D. Greer who also said he was using docent to prepare manuscripts and stuff? His manuscripts, it's not impressive to me. It's TED Talk stuff. So same with Platt. It's TED Talk stuff. I would not want these guys in a bunker with me in any kind of an apologetics conversation, to be quite honest with you, where there's real opposition. I don't want them with me. I don't. Not a drunkard. Should I say what I know? I won't. I won't say what I know about one of these pastors. One of them, I think, fails this one, to be quite honest with you, based on the testimony and evidence that I've seen. Not violent, but gentle. Gentleness doesn't describe the way that they've handled the disagreements with sheep in their congregations or congregations they want to have. Not quarrelsome. Not lovers of money. I mean, it's almost like every single one they fail. He must manage his own household well with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. I have no clue about their children. For if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? Now, here's a problem, too. If it's operating at a scale that you don't know, if you're a member of Summit or McLean, you don't even know how their children are because you don't see them around. That could also be a problem. How can you determine whether they're qualified or not if you don't see their children? He must not be a recent convert or he may be puffed up with conceit and fall into condemnation of the devil. He must be well thought of by outsiders so that he may not fall into disgrace. See, that's a problem too for these guys. It's like every single attribute just about that we know of, at least they'd fall short of just because of these situations. Patriot Tech says, I love my small Anglican church. We are small but growing. We are preaching and teaching the gospel of Christ. Amen. I cannot be a part of a mega church. Those become businesses more than churches. Couldn't have said it better. All right. Well, we're going to end the podcast. Stop putting men on a pedestal. Okay. Last comment from Kirk Phillips. And any man that lets you put him there should make you wary. Accountability and humility demand it. Yes, I would agree. Those with, as James calls it, ambition, selfish ambition, mark those people. Be aware of those people. There is a certain kind of ambition that's okay. Ambition because you have a zeal for the truth and you want people, you don't care if you get the glory or credit, but you just want people to know Christ. You want the right thing to prevail. You want God to be glorified. Selfish ambition says, I want all the credit. I want to be thought of well. I want to be known. And that's something I don't have any stomach for, it, to be quite honest with you. It's nice to get an attaboy. It's nice to get a pat on the back. But I'll be honest with you. There's been many times that I've said things, I've given information to people who had bigger platforms, and they got it out there and they got the credit for it and everything. And you know what the right response to that is? Praise God. Praise God that that it got out there and it was used. I'd rather have it help people than it not go as far, but I get the glory for it or something. That's what we need. And I, you know, I'm probably not perfect in this regard. I probably shouldn't even use myself as the example there. I think I said that because I understand what that feels like to be kind of the person carrying the bag and not just the person that's standing, delivering the speech or whatever, being the leader. You have to be able to be okay with being in both positions. But yeah, there's a lot of virtuous guys that I know who really don't care who gets the credit. They're just willing to let God use them wherever they go. And I respect that so much. You know who's like that, honestly? And I don't know if he'd appreciate me saying this, but you know who's like that is Ryan Heffelbein at the Freedom Center at Liberty University. He's one of these guys that just, he's not after the stage lights. He gets them because he represents Liberty University, but he's just not someone with selfish ambition. He's a guy that just wants the truth to go out there, wants to be helpful, wants to promote the right causes, loves the Lord. We could use some more people like that, couldn't we? That aren't just trying to hog the mic. That's the problem. So I got to land it, guys. I got vacation tomorrow morning for a few days. You could pray for me as I'm on the road. Hey, God bless. Thanks for listening. And, I really hope that despite all the negative things happening, I hope you can see, though, there is a silver lining here. We are exposing these deeds of darkness. People are seeing the template. This has gone far and wide. And if you have connections in media or you feel like the need, please tag, find the articles, post them, and tag people you'd love to see talk about this stuff. You know, I'd love to see this get more play. I'd love to see people like, you know, Tucker Carlson or, I don't know, people at the Daily Wire or something. I'd love to see them post these articles or post these documentaries or do an interview with people in these situations, because the word needs to go out. People need to be warned. This is the formula that's being used to take over these churches so that they can defend. So with that, God bless. Have a good evening and see you later.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. We carry the largest in-stock selection of Hunter ceiling fans. They provide consistent comfort all year round and also help reduce energy costs. Right now, save big on Hunter ceiling fans when you shop at Menards. View our entire selection of Hunter ceiling fans today on Menards.com. Plus our weekly flyer with plenty more great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.